This session is, Can God Find Us Through the Smog? As Barbara announced this morning, this session, this afternoon, and throughout the week at 4 o'clock, there will be sessions entitled Earth Study. Now, this isn't a geology class, but what the natural sciences tell us about the world is important for our understanding of our relation to it, and even for our understanding of God's relation to the world. In the book Order Out of Chaos, Ilya Prigogine and Isabel Stengers talk about contemporary physics and how modern physics sees the natural world not as a machine, as Newtonian science did, but as open. The subtitle of that book in its English translation is Man's New Dialogue with Nature. Pardon me for citing non-inclusive title. We might change that to Humanity's New Dialogue with Nature. And that gives us a cue for our study this week, today and the rest of the week. We can begin to see nature not as a mechanical entity subject to our control, but as having things to teach us about ourselves and our lives in the cosmos and our relation to God. One of the first lessons in Ecology 101 is that everything is connected to everything else in natural ecosystems. We might learn from this, we are beginning to learn from this, about human systems, cultural and social systems, and we might take it as a cue for learning more about our relations with one another. The title for today's session, which I have to give credit to my friend for, Can God Find Us Through the Smog, is not with the intention to imply that God is up there somewhere trying to find us somehow through the hole in the ozone layer, through the buildup of CO2 in the atmosphere, or through airborne pollutants. But perhaps that we in the industrialized Western cultures are losing ourselves and something vital in our relationship with God. If we confess with the psalmist, the earth is the Lord's, this has implications for our relationship to God and what we do with the earth. For what we have done and are doing says something about our relationship to God, what we think of God's gift of creation. We can't talk about God's continuing creation without talking about our sacrilege in despoiling its living systems. You probably won't be able to read the titles that I've put up on the board. It's printed rather small, but I just like to refer to them now and give you some introduction of what we'll be doing throughout the week. On Tuesday and Friday, there'll be both a nature walk, and after the nature walk, I'll try to get back together here and discuss some of the things that we have learned together on the nature walk, both about Holden's ecology, and on Friday particularly, about what we can do and lifestyle change, given that we may begin to see ourselves in a new relation to the earth. On Thursday, which as many of you may already know, is the commemoration of Chief Seattle, we'll discuss both resources in scripture and the speech of Chief Seattle, and if we have time, perhaps some other resources from Native American thought. And on Saturday, I've entitled that session, From Domination to Mutuality, Nature and People. I'd like to begin to have us make the connections in a more elaborate way between our domination of nature and the domination of other cultures, the domination of women. See what we can come up with in discussion about those things on Saturday. Today I'd like to just begin to get an idea of some of the basic issues in the environmental crisis and its relation to our and our Christian response. In the early days of the environmental movement, many of you probably remember, maybe were involved in some of those with the early concerns of the 70s, we began to be aware of there being a crisis. Perhaps some others of you participated in the first Earth Day activities in 1970. That was a time when many students were getting involved. I changed my major from English to natural resources, being very caught up in the environmental movement and concerned about the issues. We saw a lot of recycling programs begin and groups formed to influence legislation. But there seemed to be very little widespread change. Even as we learned about the threats to our health from environmental contamination, it seemed that didn't affect greatly a change in lifestyle either. We began to learn how complex the problems are, how they're involved and interrelated with economic interests, and in fact are global issues. We began to see that change in our treatment of the environment would mean change of lifestyle. And for many, the thought was still, I'm not going to give up my convenience and the luxury that I've worked hard for, the path to the good life, for a change, some minor changes in what really doesn't mean that much to me anyway. So we've gone through years of some organizations working on legislative change. We're beginning to see more involvement from the churches. Some of you may be involved in churches already that are active in environmental issues. But it seems to me that it's definitely time for the churches to get more actively involved. I participated in planning a conference in the Bay Area a few months ago. And for that conference, David Brower, who was a longtime environmentalist, taped a speech in which he issued a call to the churches. He said that he felt the churches are the best means to call for lifestyle change, and that's what's needed now. The churches have the means to call for repentance for the disregard of God's gifts of creation. One of the speakers at that conference spoke about our addiction in relation to the environment. Addiction, as many of you know, has become sort of a popular way of talking about sin. He paraphrased a phrase from St. Paul, "The environmental good that I want to do, I do not do. And the environmental harm that I do not want to do is what I do." I think all of us can identify with that. Secondly, the churches can call for our people to leave behind the dedication to accumulation of goods and the careless disregard for the earth that goes along with that accumulation. We can begin to question our complicity in cultural and economic systems which benefit a few and ignore the needs of the majority of people while abusing the earth. Thirdly, the churches, in continuity with the proclamation of the gospel, can help us be open to the transforming power of the life in Christ, the Spirit in nature, to a life of service and love for one another, which gives a reason for living beyond and deeper than the accumulation of goods. And lastly, the church can offer support in the community for these lifestyle changes. And as we all know, within a consumer-oriented culture, it's very difficult to maintain lifestyle changes that we might want to make. So to begin with, have to learn about the issues. Now, there are a lot of resources already available. Many of you have probably heard of the books that have been out over the years. Silent Spring, Rachel Carson was one of the early ones. There are a lot of resources in the Holden Library if you haven't had a chance to look there yet. You can find lots of good material there. And as we go on in the discussion today and throughout the week, any of the issues that that you might have particular concern about are open for discussion. Some that you might find places where you can make a difference. There are many places where each of us can make a difference. And I'd like to have us talk about those throughout the week. Here in the Holden community, we see great examples of people making a difference and of efforts at maintaining a system that is ecologically responsible. The recycling program, I think, is great. I was so impressed with it when I was here 2 weeks ago. I gave my first sermon on garbology at one of the Vesper services. We have many people resources here, as you know already. Al Pitcher is very knowledgeable and has an excellent video, which has been plugged already several times. I saw it yesterday. It's called Stopping the Coming Ice Age. It's a very vivid portrayal of some of the possibilities that may await us if we don't become more aware and change some of our practices toward the environment. As I stated earlier, the environmental movement in its early stages emphasized recycling. That is still important and is becoming more important as we see the waste buildup in garbage dumps, that garbage that we can't deal with floating on barges out in the middle of the ocean. So that's still an important issue, and one that we can do something about. But we're also becoming more aware now of the connections with broader issues. Many of the problems have always been on something of a global scale, but we're becoming more and more aware of that. You have already heard, I'm sure, much about the depletion of the ozone layer and the greenhouse effect. The consumer mentality of the West supports the cheapest means of producing goods and doesn't count the cost of pollution. We've heard something about the connection of these issues in what Tom Sine told us Saturday night about the future, and I think we'll probably hear more about that in our discussions about the economy. The issues are complex and interrelated. Our dependence on petroleum products and on chemicals, which we support by the lifestyles we live, continue to produce toxins that enter the environment, both air pollution and the chemical toxins that we don't know what to do with. And many in our society who still have a love of fast food, which supports the production of beef in what was the Amazon rainforest, which we now know has a vital connection to the survival of all of us. Just so we can have burgers at 5 cents less a pound. The earth gives us the gifts of God. We know our real dependence on its resources when we think about the food we eat and the water we drink. But our relation to nature and the earth goes beyond just our dependence on for physical survival. There's a link between connection with nature and its resources and the well-being of human life and spiritual health. We are not always aware of our own connection to nature. In urban and suburban areas, we tend to cover up nature instead of living with it, and we lose a sense of connectedness. As we learned this morning in the Bible study, we see things in a very one-dimensional way. We see a one-dimensional world and see things through rationalistic visions. And often think of our relation to nature as a rational control. I might suggest that we could move beyond even a two-dimensional view, two-dimensional meaning that there is also a spirit world, and perhaps begin to see the connections between spirit and nature, see God working through nature, God's creation in its natural systems. I've only begun to touch on some of the issues. I'd like to, if you have any comments or questions right now, I'd like you to feel free to raise them in a moment. Then, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just itching. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. In a moment, then, I'd like us to break down into groups of three or four, and consider first. Sort of two questions. First of all, look at the environment in which you live, whether it be an urban or rural environment, and as best as you can, with the knowledge you have, give it some kind of rating as to environmental quality, say on a scale of 1 to 10. Think about your immediate environment, perhaps then the city or region in which you live, and then perhaps the state. How many of you from the Northwest might have some fairly good things to report, but some of you also might see some things that would not call for a real good rating. So think about how you would rate your own environment, and then just begin to think about your own practices in relation to environmental quality around you. And then secondly, I'd like to ask the question, do you see a connection between Earth and our treatment of it and Christian faith? Okay, it sounds like you're getting into some good conversations with one another. I'd like us now to share some of that with the rest of the group. Sometimes we can get some good cross-fertilization of ideas here. If anybody in your group wants to say, first of all, we'll talk about the question about rating your environments. Or just talk about what it's like. You don't have to give a 1 to 10 rating. Just say something about evaluating the environment in which you live, the immediate and the broader environment. See if we can get a general consensus about places we live.
We can really rate on a numerical scale. We talked about using cars. That was one of the first things we talked about, using cars. And we kind of were centered around the Seattle area, I guess, and Eastern Washington. Use of cars and making more of an effort to carpool or use buses. And how there does not seem to be an incentive for people to do that. It's just too easy to get in the car, even with the high parking fees, and go where the people want to go. And someone in the group mentioned, well, you drive down the freeway and there's one person in it per car.
Right. Yeah. That's a real big problem.
Excuse me. I understand that we'll have an incentive within 2 years, that the traffic is growing so rapidly that within about 2 years, Seattle will have an incentive.
Mm-hmm. They said that 5 years ago.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Incentive raises an even more pointed question, I think, that you would speak to about the price of gallons of gasoline. That we might have incentive to drive less if gas cost us what it really cost us.
$2 or $3 a gallon. All over Europe,
I know in California we're voting on a, I guess it's been described as a modest gas tax, 9 cents a gallon, I think, to support
public transportation and alternative transportation. Yeah, that seems almost nothing. It should be 50 cents or a dollar or something like that. But it would be painful.
I never understand why we need to be forced financially into doing something. I mean, if you want gas to go up from a dollar a gallon to $5 a gallon, why don't every time you buy the gallon of gas with a dollar and then send the $4 to somebody else? Wouldn't that do it?
It might for the people in this room.
Not one of you, for all the people in this room. I'm one of those who needs to be forced. I mean, I'm quite ready to admit that. And I would be one of those who would be the first in line to vote for a law that would put a tax on gasoline of $5 a gallon right now.
Plus, Robert, I mean, where are you going to send it? I'd like to see, for example, in the Minneapolis area, there's no public transportation from the airport into the city that's effective. If I could buy a gallon of gas in Minneapolis and knew that I could send my $3 to some project that would get public transportation, I would do that. But that has to be done publicly. Pretty much public transportation does. That's a good idea.
Well, in the Seattle area where we discussed it, it's a wonderful metro system.
There is?
Yes.
With Seattle.
Wow.
It could be better, though.
It's really
always hard. Could be better, but yeah, there is a good metro system in Seattle.
It's not the best, though. I mean, it's hard to get. I mean, if you're a mother and if you need to go more than one place, mm-hmm. it's almost impossible that, you know, in a morning with rush hour. And that, and I think that we don't approach things like that people have daycare and things like that. If they don't have lines set up,
going to require in the rush hours that cars have two people or they have to wait until after the rush hour is over. If the traffic is heavy, they simply can't get out.
Yes.
I have a daughter that lives in Sweden, and they've been real concerned, in Stockholm especially, it's become just as bad as in the United States with the smog, and they just passed a new law that you pay $50 a month if you drive to work in Stockholm. And if they refuse to pay it, they will increase it. And that's to force people to use public transportation or otherwise pool their rights. And I think you could do that in the cities here, especially the ones that are most badly affected, where you have a transportation system. We have to do a whole lot to improve that, I think. But if you could do that in the biggest cities, it would really help.
Yeah.
What I appreciate about it, they don't just talk about it.
Just speak up.
What do they do with like child care? I think they've got that set up differently than we have, and as our woman over here mentioned, that would be pretty difficult.
I don't know what they do. They have a lot of child care centers right in the neighborhoods. I don't think people even have to drive, take their children. You know, they're within walking distance of where they live.
Of course, they've also got their population in much more condensed areas than the U.S. has. I don't know that you can even get into.
Dick, you've been trying to
get part of something. Yeah, one of the problems with the gas tax is it's regressive. The marginal utility of that $5 per gallon to a middle class person or a rich person is much smaller than to a poor person who's trying to get to work. So that's a tax that falls inordinately on the poor, so therefore a regressive social strategy. Let me throw that in as a possibility.
So what do you favor?
Progressive income tax for starters.
Yeah.
But until that can be sold politically, it seems to me that a proviso can be made to give certain freedoms or coupons or something to people who are under in a particular wage bracket and have to have their car to go to work.
They've got the answers to where to send the $4. Next time you buy a gallon, send the $4 to the poor people.
Right. Well, that's exactly where some of that tax money could go. Doesn't all have to come from progressive income tax, because that progressive income tax is going to affect my wallet, but it's not going to affect directly my use of gasoline.
What you're doing with that is just building another bureaucracy.
the money ought to go to developing hydrogen kind of cars. France had just, the Peugeot and Renault got together with the French government, $20 million for research for hydrogen-driven cars. We could do it, we're not doing it. There's all kinds of ways to cut the pollution and cut the carbon emissions, which are the chief problem. I think those two problems.
I think California is, and Arizona are two places I've been where they've used the diamond lanes pretty persuasively to cut down on. And I think that they need to enforce that more.
Seattle does that too.
And really demand that not allow people to make dummies that they can pull up alongside them. I mean, do some checking because to have that, you know. It's done. I know some people that have the dummy in their car.
I mean, well,
use of cars is a big problem, and I'm probably have more to say about that. Were there other issues that in your own environments that you saw as crucial ones?
Well, of course, there's always the problem of excess garbage. I mean, that seems to be the big thing at the present time. But like we mentioned here, I think that your transportation system that we used to have in this country was trains, so it was a very economical and practical method of moving merchandise has been replaced by trucks on the highway. And I think we've regressed in that aspect in the last 50 years, we've gone downhill rapidly. Any truck drivers?
Well, we raised a question of just the crunch between concerns for the environment and concerns for housing. And, you know, we see it in Bellevue and Kirkland and Woodinville and Redmond. All the wildlands and all the, you know, like the orchards of San Jose, the same kind of thing is happening where people just continuing to put up houses. One of my concerns, and I react very viscerally when I see these new housing developments that put a number of houses on a very small place, and each house is enormous. I mean, enormous! And I just feel sort of almost nauseous when I look at them. And I don't know what to do with that feeling. I have the right to build houses as big as they want.
Do they? I mean, that's I think we need to ask that question.
I feel somehow that there's something wrong about that trend.
That connects to something else that we talked about. We talked about water. We talked about Puget Sound, and it made me think of the San Francisco Bay, but water to serve those houses. Like we're in the midst of a drought where we live in San Francisco, and they're still building houses, just as you described. I don't know what people can do for water, but still building houses.
We don't look at things in terms of the connection of the issues of water, land, open space, preservation of environment, which sort of points out the compartmentalization that we tend to put things in.
Talking about water, I think the Great Lakes were an example of how they just destroyed the water there, and they're now reclaiming those so they can use the water again. But if we're such a wasteful people, we have to throw everything away, we think, you know.
Yeah, that's a real crucial part of the issue right there. We could go on about this, and we'll have more chance throughout the week to get back into some of the issues. We've got about 7 minutes yet. I've left a shorter amount of time to deal with the second question because I think it's probably a harder one, but I think it's worth getting into. Is there a connection between the way we deal with the earth, treat the earth systems, and our faith? I know if any of you in your groups have, I think several people in our group had interesting things to share, I'd like invite you to, anything that came up in your groups that you'd like to share, please do that.
I'm surprised to hear you say that that was a harder one. I thought that was an easier one.
Oh, did you? Good. Yeah. Well, somebody in our group thought it was hard.
And we just thought, because we're, I mean, I think we talked about the fact that we're just stewards of the earth, and that's it. And there's only so much earth. I mean, everything gets recycled in some sense or another. I mean, we can make it vary for a while, but the things we do with the earth stay with it and are part of it, and we're responsible for that. So it seems that, to me, there's a real, real clear connection.
I think it's the harder one because of what we're caught up in the whole enculturation process, what we're tempted to do. I can really relate to what you were just saying about the houses going up. I left the Woodinville, Issaquah, Redmond area a little over 2 years ago and moved up here. And after being thoroughly burned out, but I mean thoroughly burned out, it took me a long time to convince myself that I could escape that. And I was building those, you know, $3.5 million homes, one after another, all over that plateau up there. And I found it a very oppressive thing, but it was at a very subtle level and hard to get away from. Easy to stay stuck in.
I want to point out to you that, like in Asia, you have a lot of slash and burn, of people who do slash and burn for raising their little garden plot and making a go of it. But this is what they know, this is all they know, and this is their means of eking out a living. And so they slash and burn, and the soil gets depleted because the tropical soil doesn't have what temperate soil does. It leaches out, the waters leach out what's good in it. And then they've got to move on and slash and burn in a few years so they can have another garden. But what do you do about, now we're talking about existence living. What would you do about that?
What I do personally?
Well, I mean, I could see education is one thing, but that takes a long time.
You get the World Bank to insist on land redistribution in return for low-income.
You loan those countries money, it never ends up with the little farmer.
I'm saying, yeah. Insist on land redistribution. The land is so unequal in terms of its distribution in most of the countries.
Yeah, but of course, where you're doing slash and burn, the land, I don't know who the land belongs to, but it surely does not necessarily belong to that poor peasant who's burning down the tree.
But as I understand, they're forced to move to the periphery. Real agriculture, arable land, because they don't have access to any other kind of land.
Well, I think they've done this for centuries. They're living more or less where they have been. I don't know, I'm not talking now
certainly
about
not in the degree to which it's happening now.
The Brazilian Amazon area, because that's relatively new. But in Asia, you've got a lot of slash and burn.
Your question raised something that I think you want to talk about at some point is, where does the third world fit into this environmental crisis that we're in? How are really poor, undeveloped countries going to deal with not having the opportunity to develop and despoil the environment the way we've had the opportunity to?
The whole issue of Christian mission, what Jane was talking about in her session this morning in Africa and how her role as missionary, you know, and how mission has changed Christian mission in terms of educated women, Muslim women to garden plots and reevaluating the purpose of mission, Christian mission, what that means. And I think she, in the session of those that were there, I think was sort of trying to evaluate how effective her mission had been. And I think that the fact that she taught people to do gardens she did a fantastic deed of God's work, whether she converted Muslims who've been Muslims for centuries is not the point. She did God's work. And I think we have to reevaluate our purpose.
I want to say something about Africa. We had a big program for measles and smallpox vaccination, which was very good. And we also had some programs for digging new wells. And the result of that was that more children lived, and with the increased wells, they could have more cattle, and they needed more cattle. But of course, the cattle trampled everything around the wells. You ended up with more desert, and kids living past their first and second year, but dying of starvation later on. And then when you start your feeding programs, no farmer can compete with free food in the city. And so you deplete your cadre of farmers. There is no easy solution.
Yeah, I'm
glad to see that they're doing a little gardening, but
those issues are real complex. Excuse me, Jane had her hand up before. Maybe you want to say something.
Yeah, just responding to the same thing. I mean, I think it's good to point out that traditional systems aren't necessarily sustainable. The slash and burn system, which I agree was traditional in many places, worked simply because there were few enough people that they could leave the land fallow for a very, very long time and was able to regenerate itself. It's population pressures that make those systems no longer environmentally sound at all. It's the same issue with the cattle, as you said. Cattle raising is a great system, but you have to have enough land so that it's not overgrazed. And I guess the point is that it, being responsible to the environment isn't just going back to some former days when everyone was concerned about the environment. It's just that some all worked but they weren't. We really have to find new systems, new technologies. As people who are working in new kinds of organic gardening or something that I get excited about hearing, it's really developing new systems. We can't just go back and give up everything that has been done.
You're talking about population.
A population explosion.
Small land.
We've got about time for one or two more comments, and then we've got it wrapped up.
The first gentleman said that the connection, that there certainly is a connection, and it has to do with that we are stewards, but we haven't spent much time at all in developing a theology of stewardship, because, I mean, I know something about that area, but I feel so totally ignorant, or almost totally ignorant, at least not wise enough to stand up in almost any group and say then what stewardship means in some very concrete and practical and helpful kinds of ways. And I
excellent point. I think that's true. Did you have your hand up back here?
Well, I think that for a long time we've had the attitude in our religion that God had placed man upon the earth as to have dominion over things. And that has been a really bad effect. It's only been recently that we've started realizing that we are stewards and not one in control. And it's going to take time for that to come into effect. And I think that's something we really have to think about and develop more.
Very good point that ties in closely with what this gentleman just said. Well, we've just begun really to scratch the surface of some of the issues. We do need to close now, but hope we can continue the discussion. Yeah, you
can. Can I make just one announcement? This is an announcement, and I'm highly distractible. I may have missed something you said when you were summarizing the resources that are available at Holden. There is also a resource center right here next
Great.
To the library.
Thanks.
And there are also brochures in the entry to the dining room that come from the resource center. And if you are looking for anything on this particular issue and what would Al too refer to sometimes, I'd love to be able to try to help you find them, and I'm in there. I like to come to sessions, but when a session's not on most of the day, I'm in the Resource Center and would be glad to help you.
Thanks.
Sorry to
interrupt. No, I appreciate that very much. Well, thank you all for being here and participating.